Chapter 16. The veldt stretches out before them. The keaki bushes tremble in the warm wind, dark thorny scrubs whose gentle tremors call to mind an animal trying very hard not to be seen. The thirst grass conspires with the breeze, whispers and shushes and hissed hushes. Red feathery clouds streak across the open sky, a sky the color of blush and bloom. A lone ship crosses it, some cargo ship probably, one of the few travelers to this distant world of Iridiru. Down there, among the grass and the scrub, sits a compound. The compound has seven buildings. Each sits squat and rectangular, each made of blonde brick and blood-red mortar, each with rail-top roofs and round porthole windows and water catchment tanks. One of the buildings is different, though. A manse larger and more ostentatious than the other, more austere buildings. The house is surrounded by a screened-in porch, a xeriscape garden, and a series of shimmering and shifting hollow statues. A droid with many extensor limbs flits about, tending to the garden and tuning up the statues. Otherwise, the compound is silent and still. And it has been for the better part of the last day. This is the compound of Golos Aram. What the crew knows about Aram is little, but perhaps enough. The big-headed Cynatine was once employed by the Galactic Empire as an architect. A prison architect, in fact. Aram designed some of the Empire's most notable prisons, including the Lemnis Gate beneath Coruscant, the floating asteroid prison of Orko 9, and the Goa Penal Colony. Aram's reported specialty was making prisons that were self-sustaining and inescapable. He considered it his art. Thing is, he didn't work only for the Empire. He operated freelance, too, helping design and build prisons for the Kanji Club, for the Junahar Cartel, even for Splugora the Hutt. Aram is retired, supposedly. Just the same, Aram is the only Imperial connection out here on Iridiru. He's the one good lead they have. But what happens when they go pulling on that thread? Will they find Han Solo? Or will the whole thing fall apart? Could they be putting Solo in danger? The narrative they can put together for Solo is shaky at best. The Millennium Falcon got into a scrap not far from Warren Station. Han had transmitted after that, but whatever he was investigating sure stirred up trouble. Given the presence of that Prowler droid, plus the information from Black Sun, and the sheer manic glee of Tashu regarding Iridiru, there's cause to worry. So if Han was here investigating Aram, then what? After that, the narrative phrase. Why look into Aram at all? Did Aram catch Solo sniffing around? Is Solo in prison? Or is he looking for someone in prison? Either way, it's what they have. So here they are. From their hiding spot atop a gentle hilltop plateau, Nora leans forward, parting the sharp-bladed thirst grass like a curtain and peering out through a pair of macro binoculars. Using the dial on the side, she scans through the heat signatures, then clicks over to electric and electronic indicators. The binocs highlight a series of danger spots all around the compound. They glow red in the view screen. I see them, she tells Jazz. Jazz, who lies unseen in the tall grass, even though she's only a few meters away. The binocs highlight that the compound is ringed by an invisible perimeter fence, a barrier of ghosted lasers, impossible to see, but sure to cut you apart if you marched through them. The ground leading up to the compound, both in and out of the fence, is littered with landmines. Then, located throughout the compound, are turret droids. Each hides in plain sight near vaporators, looking like part of the mechanism. Stealthy buggers, those. Through the grass, Jazz says,
The place is loaded for war. Aram's protecting himself. I get that he's paranoid, given the changes cascading through the galaxy. But this is a whole other level. He's afraid. And he hasn't come out in days.
From behind them, Nora hears Temin working on something. A tink, 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 followed by a buzzing twist from a microspanner. What is he doing back there? Nora's about to ask when the grass swishes and shakes as Sinjir crawls up on his belly.
Ow!
He says, flexing his hand and popping the knuckle of his thumb in his mouth.
This grass is slicing me to bits.
He drinks your blood,
Jazz says, easing closer.
Thrustgrass sustains itself on the creatures who walk through it. Little sips from little cuts.
He frowns.
Lovely.
I'm here for my hourly update. And my hourly update is, I am bored. Bored out of my skull.
That's always your hourly update,
Nora says.
Because it's true, every hour.
It's my update too,
Temin says, crawling up next to them.
Seriously, this is awful. I want to burn all this grass, and the thorny bushes, and the flies.
As if to demonstrate, he swats at the back of his hand.
See? Ugh, I should have stayed on Chandrilla.
Can't we just go back to Kai Pompos?
Sinjir asks.
We'd make it by nightfall. There's a little drinkery round the back of the town. They have a still where they ferment this root, this Corva root. So we go back, we tip back a few under the Iridiru moons, we reformulate our strategy. This is a fact-finding mission,
Nora says, feeling like a mom commanding a child to stay put.
We stay here until all the facts are found.
Facts are, Temin says, the guy isn't coming out. He's dug in like a blood bug.
They'd heard rumors that Aram was a big game hunter, and thought maybe that would afford them an opportunity to get close to him. But so far, no go. Nor has he gone out for supplies, or even a breath of fresh air. They've seen neither hide nor hair of the man, just droids.
Here's what we do. We take Mr. Bones.
Bones sits crumpled up behind them, his skeletal body folded tightly with his head bowed and his arms enclosing his knees.
And we let Bones march down there, find the guy, drag him up here onto the plateau, and we question him. Simple.
As simple as chasing birds with a hammer,
Sinjir mutters.
Everyone hush,
Jazz says.
Timon, did you build my thing or not?
Yeah, yeah.
He fishes around in his pocket and holds up a pair of devices in the palm of his hand. One looks like a round from a slug thrower, but it's been modified. The shell casing crimps around a circuit bulb, and the tip of that bulb has four little prongs, like insect mandibles. The second device is round, no bigger than a button, with a little zigzag antenna sticking out.
It's a bug,
Temin says, sounding impressed with himself.
This planet has enough bugs without us adding more to it,
Sinjir grouses.
And before anyone corrects me, yes, I know, it's a listening bug, and not a real bug, and...
Oh, never mind. Good job, Jazz. Now what?
They can't get eyes on, so we need to get ears on. I load this into my rifle, and fire it right at his mans. Then...
She grabs the second device.
This jury-rigged earpiece with which to listen in.
Clever, Sinjir says. Still not sure what I'm doing here.
Jazz hands him the earpiece.
You're going to do the listening.
Joy.
He makes a face as he takes it and screws it into his ear. The bounty hunter unslings the slug thrower from her back. Nora again grabs the binocs and focuses them at the compound. A herd of animals have come up alongside the invisible perimeter. Long-limbed, long-necked, leathery things, these beasts. They number in the dozens. Some stop to nip at the tufts of kiaki bushes, while the others bat at one another with bony protuberances atop their narrow snouts. Nora is pretty sure they're morak. Big things, but herbivores. Though she'd hate to get stomped onto those long legs. Legs that end in claw-tipped feet. Jazz pulls the slug thrower close and uses her thumb to pop open a bipod at the end of the barrel, giving it stability. She tugs the scope tight against her eye. Nora watches her through the grass, the
the way Jazz draws a deep breath, then slowly exhales it, until no breath remains, and she is still. It's surprisingly close to what Luke taught Leia, isn't it? Shut out the world. Be mindful, but empty. Like a cup to be filled up.
Of course, Jazz does this in order to kill people more efficiently. The bounty hunter's finger coils around the trigger. But then, the Morak all look up at the same time. A gesture of alarm. Nora reaches out and touches Jazz's shoulder.
Wait. What is it?
Jazz asks. Something's up.
Sinjir plucks the earpiece out of his ear, scowling at it.
This thing is fritzing out. It's making this high-pitched whine, wretched sound.
Down below, the Morak begin to move. All of them at once. A herd movement. They go from walking to galloping, their long, bony legs launching them forward with a swiftness that surprises Nora. The animals are headed toward the hill where the crew is waiting. Closer, closer. The ground begins to vibrate beneath them. It's too steep, surely. They can't. The animals reach the bottom of the hill and begin to scramble up the side of it. The clawed feet make great haste, and now Nora knows what those claws are for. Dust spirals behind them.
They're coming right for us.
We have to move, Nora cries. Move!
She and the others spring up out of hiding and turn tail, bolting through the grass. The Morak crest the hill, bleeding and blowing mucus from their snouts. The ground rumbles as the herd stampedes. The grass slices at Nora's arms, but she can't waste time caring. Everyone moves fast. Everyone except Bones, who sits somewhere undercover and is hopefully resilient enough to suffer the knocks and blows of the Morak. She's not even sure where they should go. Run straight? Turn to the side? The Morak are coming right up behind them. One lopes past Nora in a lumbering gallop, swiping at her with its long neck. The thing is twice her height, and she just barely darts out of its way, even as others come up behind her. Ahead, though she can't see it, the far side of the hill awaits. What then? Run down it? Trying not to fall? Duck and pray the charging Morak go over the edge? The bounty hunter runs next to her, and when one Morak comes behind her, Jazz jabs at it with the barrel of her slug thrower, and the beast roves drunkenly toward Nora. It clips her, and she staggers. Her legs go out from under her. There's Temin, grabbing her by the belt to keep her from falling. It's just enough to help her get her legs back under her. Nora is about to thank her son. She doesn't get the chance. A sound hits them. A sonic hum. Suddenly, the Morak are squawking and turning sharply away, the herd splitting in twain as if by an invisible wedge. Nora thinks, thank the stars for whatever is doing that. But then something lands in the grass in front of them. The thing rolls a few times like a flung rock. It beeps three times in succession. Then, an implosive sound. The air lights up around them. A hard pulse of bright light. It concusses the air, too, hitting her like a thunderclap. Nora is suddenly blind and deaf, her ears ringing, her vision washed away in a tide of searing white. She fumbles for the blaster at her side. She whips it out, and it's suddenly rocked out of her hand, clattering away. A shape emerges in front of her as the white light begins to recede. A person shape. Nora thinks. Aram has us. We thought we were watching him, but he was watching us. She leans forward, starts to stand.
Don't move,
comes a voice, quiet but urgent. Nora asks as her eyes adjust.
Who is that? Who's there?
The figure steps forward. She spies two blasters held aloft, one in each hand and one pointed right at her.
Name's Han Solo, captain of the Millennium Falcon. Who the hell are you?